okay for anybody else who wouldn't mind having a shorter meeting today, let's get started. It's time. So this is the April 11th meeting of the Active Transportation Committee. We're here. Do we have anybody on the phone today? I didn't hear anybody yet, so anyway. So first thing we should do, welcome everybody, and then let's do introductions around the table. You want to start here?
Heather McLaughlin, the old WSRC staff.
Ben Bolte, Green Mike.
Joe Taylor, UTA.
Bill Wright, Mayor Payson.
Bill Silvercorn, Salt Lake County.
Christy Overson, Taylor's City Mayor.
Jory Donner, Wasatch Front Regional Council.
Scott Hess, Wasatch Front Regional Council.
Jeff Silvestrini, Mill Creek.
Andrew Gruber, WFRC.
Joe Sheldon, South Weaver City Mayor.
Brett McGiff, Utah Department of Health.
Myron Bateman, Tooele County.
Heidi Goodhart, UDOT Planning.
Katie Gerard, Wasatch Front Staff.
Richard Heyer, Ogden City Council, representing Weber County.
Carol Valentine, Morgan County Council.
Hey, you can start back there.
Ben Withridge, Wasatch Front Regional Council Staff.
Fred Daring, UDOT, Region 1.
Ted Knowlton, WFRC Staff.
Carly Hawes, WFRC Staff.
Megan Townsend, WFRC Staff.
Dave Elsis, Cycling Utah.
Rose Alvino, there's my home.
Helen Peters, Salt Lake County.
Tim Hardy, Rocks and Peters.
Lee Davenport, WFRC Staff.
Ned Hacker with the WFRC Staff.
Sean Seeger with Mountain Land Association Government Staff.
Thank you. Okay, well,
there. Barry Burt, Davis County.
All right, thank you, everybody. So we have minutes to approve. They were circulated by email anyway. Are there any questions or concerns about them? Somebody want to make a motion?
I'll move to approve.
I'll second.
Okay, did you get who made the motion? Okay, all in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? The minutes are approved. Thank you. Other members of the public that would like to address the committee? Okay, seeing none, we'll have a similarly brief chair's report. I don't have much to report, so I won't, other than the fact that the, we'll hear about this later, but the Golden Spoke Committee has been meeting and still moving forward on that, and that event will occur before our next meeting, so I encourage everybody to participate and attend. If you have questions, you can call Mr. Hess here, so, okay.
Can I add something?
Sure.
So we've talked in our previous meetings about the outcomes of the legislative session. As you all know, there were some significant developments, most notably Senate Bill 136, which passed, which provides some new funding opportunities for counties to identify revenues that can be used for road projects, transit projects, and those funds are flexible and can be utilized for active transportation projects. There's a different sort of mix of funds that are authorized at the local level depending on each county. We've put together some detailed materials that show what's eligible county by county. Lanise has sent that information out. If you haven't received that, let us know and we can share a copy of that with you. But at the local level, options for counties to move forward and generate additional revenues which could be used for active transportation. Also, the legislation asks UDOT to take a broader perspective on the prioritization of the funds that flow through the state. To broaden their strategic initiatives, to think more broadly about the relationship between land use at the local level and the state transportation infrastructure investments. And Heidi, I'm not going to put you on the spot here, but what we might do perhaps at a future meeting of the Active Transportation Committee is maybe ask you to come back and give a little respectfully, if I can suggest this, Mr. Chairman.
You can suggest anything.
Okay, I can suggest anything. Thank you. Maybe we could have a little discussion at our next meeting about how active transportation specifically is being looked at as UDOT is updating its strategic initiatives and prioritization criteria for the funding.
Yeah, absolutely. I'd be happy to.
Cool. Thank you very much.
Okay. And did you get that suggestion?
I did.
Okay.
Thank you.
All right.
Thanks, Andrew. Okay. Dave, do you want to talk about Bike Month?
My name is Dave Altus with Cycling Utah. We typically maintain the Utah Bike Month calendar of events. May is National Bike Month, and it was started in 1956 by the League of American Bicyclists, and so it's a month-long celebration of the bike. And there are a number of things that happen during that month, from National Bike to Work Day, Bike to School Day. In Utah, it's recognized typically by the governor with a proclamation declaring that May is Bike Month. We just updated the calendar this morning, so I'm going to kind of go through a couple of the key events that are happening during the month. It sort of kicks off on the 28th of April with the Tour de Brutah, which is a Salt Lake City brewery tour on via the bike. In Provo, Bike to Work Day is going to be May 1st. Salt Lake on May 5th is going to have an open street celebration, which looks like it's going to be really fantastic this year. It's there's a section of downtown that they'll close completely and be open just for pedestrians, bicyclists, and I suppose skateboarders, people that want to do yoga in the streets. There's all sorts of things. It's basically returning the streets to being part of the community rather than just for cars. And at the Utah Bike Summit, you heard Penarosa, that talked about how the Ciclovia has about 50,000 people in South America. So hopefully someday maybe we could get to that in Salt Lake City. May 9th is National Bike to School Day. May 12th and 13th is the Cyclofem ride. There's one in Provo, and there's usually one that happens in Salt Lake City it's a women's only ride. May 14th through 18th is National Bike to Work Week and National Bike Week. That's typically when mayors will often have a bike to work day. In Logan has already has their calendar set up for that week. Salt Lake City on Tuesday is going to have a bicycle pit stop. So if you're riding around in downtown Salt Lake, there are usually four or five locations where you can stop in, get a bagel, get a cup of coffee on your way to work. That's really a pretty fun thing to do to kick off your morning. May 16th is National Ride of Silence Day, and the Ride of Silence is a ride that takes place to honor cyclists who have been either killed or hit on their bicycles. It's usually about a 5 to 7 mile ride in Salt Lake. It goes around the downtown area and out to Liberty Park and such. And the whole ride is done in silence as a way to memorialize fallen cyclists. There's also going to be one in Provo. There may be another one or two popping up throughout the state. That happens sometimes. May 17th is going to be Salt Lake City's Bike to Work Day. We haven't yet heard from if there's going to be a Salt Lake County Bike to Work Day. Typically, they've combined the two. Last year, I think, I'm not sure what happened with Salt Lake County, but hopefully Salt Lake County will be doing a Bike to Work Day in conjunction with Salt Lake City's. May 18th is Friday. That's the designated National Bike to Work Day. So that's when everybody, should be out there riding to work if you can. And then the Bike Month typically, well, the Golden Spoke, we'll add that to the calendar as part of this Bike Month calendar on June 2nd, and then Bike Month closes out on June 9th with the Salt Lake City Bicycle Collective's Bike Prom. And that's has a pre-event ride, and then it's a prom where you ride to the prom on your bicycle. So, and if anyone has any bike events that you want me to add to this, please email me, dave@cyclingutah.com.
So, thanks, Dave. So I think we should go around the room and see if there are any bike to work events planned in our region, if anybody's got anything going on that. I will get you a date. I can tell you that with respect to Mill Creek, and I haven't actually met with Mayor McAdams on this, but he's been talking to the same people that I've been talking to at the Larry Miller Group and Tour of Utah. We are going to try to organize a riding event in up Mill Creek Canyon and a kind of a bike festival at the Olympus Hill Shopping Center in Mill Creek sometime in June, I think. That may or may not be a kickoff to a project that we're contemplating to put in bike lanes in Mill Creek Canyon in Salt Lake County. So we won't have that done by June by any means, because there's some road widening that's part of that project and then some striping. But it's a popular canyon for people to ride in, and we want to make it a little safer. There are parts of it that are narrow. So I'll get you a date on that when we finalize it. We're still kind of trying to organize it. So.
Great.
Anybody else have anything that you know about going on in your jurisdiction?
I'm sorry if I missed it, Dave. Did you have open streets on there?
Yeah, May 5th. Anyone else?
Scott the Golden Spoke.
Yes. So on June 2nd, Saturday, June 2nd, will be the Golden Spoke.
Yeah, I'll add that to this.
And then what's the easiest way for folks to get this calendar?
It's on our website. If you search Utah Bike Month and go to cyclingutah.com, that's
awesome.
And I'll send out a link so that maybe you can send it out to the whole list here. And,
yeah, that'd be great.
Thank you.
Okay.
Thanks, Dave. Okay, Ben, do you want to talk about the TIP program?
Well, as many of you are aware, this is a time of year that's fairly exciting here in the development of the identification of the new projects for the Transportation Improvement Program. What we're going to review here quickly, the sheets that are coming around, these 11 by 17 sheets, these are actually the projects that were submitted and discussed for evaluation for the Transportation Alternative Program. But before we get into those projects, what I'd like to do, maybe hit the lights. To remind you kind of where we are in our schedule. So during the month of September, latter part of September, early October is when we sent out a request for letters of intent. Many of you, hopefully all of you, received that notification that those letters of intent come back. Staff does a real high level preliminary evaluation and then request concept reports that are due by the middle part of January. And then those concept reports begin through an evaluation process from mid-January through the end of March. At the end of March, the technical advisory committees meet. Those are the bodies. There's the Salt Lake West Valley Technical Advisory Committee, and then there's the Ogden-Layton Technical Advisory Committee. Those committees are made up of the engineers and the city officials that will make recommendations to Transcom. So the sheets that you have before you are the recommendations that have come from those bodies that meeting met on, or those committees met on the 28th of March. So in the dots represent projects in the Ogden-Layton urban area, their colors reference here. So we had 50 projects that were submitted for consideration in the Ogden-Layton urban area. Total estimated project cost there for the projects alone. This is for all the funding sources, the Surface Transportation Program, or STP, Congestion Mitigation Air Quality, which is the CMAQ, and then the Transportation Alternative Program, or the TAP. All of those projects totaling almost $295 million in request. There was $17.4 million available in STP, and there was almost $110 million request for that $17-plus million. In the CMAQ, there was just $14 million almost requested against about $3.6 million. And in the TAP, there was just a little more, or just shy of $600,000 available, and there was a request more than $5 million towards that. In the Salt Lake area, it was similar. We had 51 projects totaling more than $137 million in request. STP, there was a little more than $30 million available. CMAQ, there was 4.7 plus available. TAP, there was 990 available. But you can see the demands on the funds, the needs that exist along the Wasatch Front. So in the Surface Transportation Program, yes.
Let me just interrupt you for 1 second. Just so everybody's clear, you just showed what we call the Ogden-Layton urbanized area, right, which is the southern Box Elder County, Weber and Davis.
Correct.
You showed the Salt Lake area, which is obviously Salt Lake County. The reason that you didn't show Utah County, for example, is because MAG does this process for Utah County. And yes. The reason that you didn't show Morgan and Tooele counties is because those areas are not in the so-called urbanized areas. So these programs are available, but they're administered by UDOT in Morgan and Tooele counties.
Thank you, Andrew.
Ben's not leaving anybody out. Well, he is, but there's a reason for that in
there
this
is.
Case. So we administer these funding programs with these federal funds, specifically in WFRC's urbanized area, which includes from southern Box Elder County through Salt Lake County.
Thank you.
Okay.
So with that, the clarification, I appreciate that. In the Ogden-Layton urban area in both urban areas, in the STP, there were 7 projects that were recommended. And out of the $17 million that was available, almost the full amount was programmed. In the Salt Lake, there were 14 projects that were recommended. Out of the 30.7 available, 30.4 was recommended. In the congestion mitigation, there was 5 projects recommended in the Ogden-Layton urban area for a total of 3.6 plus million. 8 projects recommended in the Salt Lake West Valley urban area for 4.7 plus million. In the TAP program, there were 3 projects recommended in the Ogden-Layton area utilizing $571,000, and then 4 projects recommended in the Salt Lake area using the full requested or the full available amount of the $990,000 plus. So the intent, what I'd like to do is go through these sheets here quick on the projects that were recommended, and then we can discuss some of the projects. So as you look at this sheet with the staple in the upper left-hand corner, you're looking at the front. And this begins, the front and the back of this are the projects that were recommended in the Ogden-Layton urban area. The projects that have a highlighted cell going down the left column are the projects that were recommended, and in that dark blue cell, you'll see the amount that was recommended towards that project. The same format is for the Salt Lake urban area. So starting with the first project there, this first project up in Plain City, located on 1975 North, this request was for more than $1 million, more than double what was available. The idea was to widen 1975 North. And there's an open ditch, but it was to widen the facility so that you could have a clear shoulder, curb gutter, and sidewalk for those pedestrian bicycle traffic. With those funds not available, we approached the city and asked where the greatest needs were in this area. The greatest needs actually existed right here on the east end. What we've got is a mid-block crossing right here where the street begins to narrow. The idea then would be to add the curb gutter and sidewalk and improvements here to the south side of the road, moving the pedestrian crossing over to the intersection where it would be anticipated by the motoring traffic. And working with the city on this, this project would be probably somewhere in the neighborhood of less than $400,000. So the technical advisory committee recommended that we program $300,000 towards this project to accomplish this portion right here. The next project down in Farmington City, this kind of had a two-part to it. There were two pedestrian crossings. One is located on Clark Lane, and the other one here was on State Street. And out on the field review, it was identified that this crossing here on State Street was the one that had the most significant impact. You come up over the freeway, over the State Street, over the freeway, there you got some vertical concerns there, but when you're coming in, or as you come over, the crosswalk is right here. As you come back, the sight distance poor, the vertical clearance is poor. Sometimes in the day you're coming over and the sun's right in the eyes of those motorists. And so there's some significant concern there. There's also been a fatality in this particular location. So the technical advisory committee recommended that we program $200,000 to address this crossing right here, to move the crossing, to put up crossing signals and address the issue there. The last project that was recommended was for some construction of sidewalk along Clark Lane right here in Farmington City. There's a home that's kind of in the middle of nowhere. There's a nice hotel on the one side and an engineering firm on the other side, and the sidewalk ends. The idea was for the city to come in, take care of the right-of-way issues, and then these funds would address the completion of the sidewalk along Clark Lane. And that was recommended at the $71,000+. So that was the projects that were recommended in the Ogden-Layton area. So if you were to turn that page over, that's the remaining part of the project. You'll notice down lower on the lower left-hand corner there of the table, you've got the total amount that was recommended, the $571,000+. The funds that were available is over more in the middle of the bottom of the page there, $591,000. Moving into the Salt Lake urban area, the first project was in Cottonwood Heights. This is on 2700 East sidewalk. This was to construct a sidewalk on the east side of 2700. You've got a slope that comes right down onto the road. All of the pedestrian traffic that comes down from the neighborhood generally stays on that shoulder. They don't cross the street over to where the sidewalk exists until they get further down to where the crossing guard is. And so the idea is to construct that sidewalk on the east side of that facility, providing a safe for both bicycle and pedestrian as they travel down that road to the school and the other attractions that exist on the west side of the facility. TAC committee recommended the full requested amount of $363,000. The next project is in the Kearns area, metro area there. This is a safe routes to school project. And what this would do, well, dang, jumped to the end already. Anyway, the TAC recommended the full $193,000 that was requested on this project for curb gutter and sidewalk improvements along this facility. What's actually happening on this is there's a rail crossing that runs along here, and that's where the students generally are up walking because it's continuous and it exists. And are up on that rail facility. The idea is to make the improvements down to where the sidewalk is non-existent to provide a safe area for both bike and pedestrian use. Then the last project, I guess there's two more. This one here was a tail-end project. We backed into this project after we programmed the other projects. This is for on the UTA buses. Generally, the bike racks that they have on there on the older buses are just for two bikes. This is to replace that two bike rack and put a three bike rack on the buses. This is an incremental project. It can be done. So the remaining amount of $33,000 was recommended for this project. The last major project, the sidewalk project along 3300 South there in Mill Creek, was to construct sidewalk on the north side of 3300 South between 2600 East and 2700 East. If you're familiar with this facility, if you're proceeding westbound on 33rd, you get to where the right turn pocket will turn, and then there's guardrail across protecting the yard across the street. The idea is to construct the sidewalk and make the improvements necessary to provide a safe facility for bike and pets. The requested amount was for $400,000. The TAC recommended the full requested amount. So then, where does that leave us? So that concludes on the TAP program there. So if you look down there in the lower left-hand corner, you have $990,000 plus, and the exact amount that was available was programmed. That's because we backed in on that UTA on the bike rack and were able to utilize all the funds available. So out of the other programs then, because of time constraint, let me just show you here. Out of all the other projects that were recommended, every one of these projects has a significant active transportation component. And running through them real quick, where they could be is like on Farmington City, for example. These are the Ogden-Layton urban area with SDP and CMAQ projects. These are the Salt Lake West Valley urban area with the SDP and CMAQ funded projects. Real quick, running through Farmington City, SR 106, that's Main Street. There's no sidewalk. There's very little shoulders. This is to construct curb gutter and sidewalk on the west side of this facility. Currently, school children walk in the road, or those waiting for the bus stand on the road in the traffic lane waiting for or going to and from school. Of course, you've heard of about the expansion or the construction of the BRT up in the Ogden-Layton urban area from the Intermodal Center up to the university. Caseville Farmington area, this addresses a connector from the West Davis corridor to Shepherd Lane, but there's several connector roads that provide alternative routes for active transportation that will have sidewalk, curb gutter, and shoulder as well. South Ogden on 40th Street, this will construct some missing sidewalk as well as reconstruct the 40th Street in Shines View. North Salt Lake Main Street construction. This is an area where they're preparing for some significant growth with the development of the park on the west side of the road. This will also provide for shoulder improvements and sidewalk. Then we've got the Polk Avenue. This is a sidewalk project. This initially came in as a TAP project, but was a good CMAQ candidate. Was recommended through to the CMAQ program. In the Salt Lake area, West Jordan, 7800 South, this environmental, there's some significant improvements in the long range plan on 70th South. But that's not only for the automobile, that's also for pedestrian and bike improvements along this facility. Draper City, 1300 East, this is phase two. We'll take a narrow two-lane facility, make it a three-lane uniform cross section with curb gutter, sidewalk, and shoulder improvements with bike lanes. Salt Lake County, West Valley, Kearns area, 4700 South reconstruction. This will also improve 4700 where there's no existing sidewalk to not only reconstruct this facility, but widen it enough with shoulder, curb gutter, and sidewalk. 13th East, this is a reconstruction project, but brings with it the complete streets. Thank you. Good job. That's it'll bring in the complete streets factor in this portion on 1300 East. Salt Lake City, 700 West. If familiar with this facility, very beat up, very old, has no sidewalk in many of the portions, poor drainage, no shoulders. This will reconstruct the facility with curb gutter and sidewalk and shoulders with bike lane. West Jordan, 7800 South, 1500 West. This is actually a ped crossing that will cross 70th South there in front of the elementary school. The Magna Metro Township, this is a sidewalk project to construct missing sidewalk on the west side of 80th West, Bluffdale City. This is for the study to get vehicles and bike and ped through that narrow crossing under the rail structure there to 146. Mill Creek and Holiday Cities, 39 South, improvements there, reconstruct the facility as well as improvements to curb gutter and sidewalk with the improvements to shoulders for bike lane. Taylorsville City, BRT connector route from the college over to the where the BRT line will circulate along Redwood Road. University of Utah Hospital stop improvements for the buses to improve circulation up and around the University Hospital. West Jordan on 8600 South. This will construct a bridge over the Mount View corridor, tying both ends of West Jordan in together, providing a facility that'll be wide enough for bike and ped on sidewalks as well as bike lanes with shoulders or in the shoulder. Salt Lake City Green Bike Share Program and the expansion to that ongoing program. And Bluffdale City, 146 South sidewalk and bike lanes from the rail structure to Redwood Road to the west. So that's all the projects there as well. Any questions? Please.
Two questions. One is on the Weber County area. You're 20,000-ish shy of funding. Why didn't you fund the bike racks there like you did in the Salt Lake area for that, to use up all that 20,000?
And that's a good request. It wasn't recommended at the TAC. At the time, the TAC recommended that those funds just stay in the reserve for either a project shortfall or to be programmed next year.
And then the second question is, most of these, the majority of these seem like sidewalk projects and not as much emphasis on bicycle projects. Is there a reason for, you know, why that?
I can speak to not necessarily Wasatch Front's criteria selection, but our pedestrian fatalities are composing nearly 20% of our overall roadway fatalities. So we have a lot of catching up to do with pedestrian facilities providing safe places to walk. So that's like safety's. Yeah, we're trying to do more for more of our vulnerable roadway users. So, you know, we're looking at active transportation, especially at the DOT's Mature Wasatch Front's approach to that as well.
Thank you. And in addition to that, generally whenever we have a sidewalk improvement, there's very rarely that we're not addressing with the shoulder improvement as well. It's just quicker to say curb gutter, sidewalk, and shoulder.
Another. So just for clarification on this, because there's a lot of colors and a lot of, you know, it's a lot going on. So the green projects, if you follow the scoring criteria over, are scored with our Safe Routes to School criteria. The gray project is a standard TAP project, and then in the Salt Lake area, we did have a request for planning. So the pink or salmon color is scored via the planning scoring. So it's one funding source, but it can be utilized three different ways. And our region has chosen to not separate Safe Routes to School funding from TAP, from a review and utilization. And so in some years, you get more Safe Routes to School projects or benefits. In other years, you get more standard TAP projects, which might be bike routes. But a number of factors go in. If you go to the furthest right column, there's the actual just numerical scores that were given by our scoring criteria. And you notice we don't just fund top to the bottom. Part of that is local involvement, local desire, professional recommendations. So there's a number of factors that go into this, but these, between the region's recommendations and then the locals at the TAC, these were what filtered to the top from a recommendation from the technical advisory committees to be funded through our program. So I think it ebbs and flows on bike versus sidewalk.
Thank you, Scott.
Thanks, Ben.
Thank you.
Ben, just to be clear, the list that you handed out is just the TAP program,
right?
Transportation Alternatives Program. What you're showing on the screen right now are projects that are funded through the other programs, STP and CMAQ,
correct,
that have a benefit to active transportation, bike or ped, correct?
Correct.
Okay. And all of that list there and this list here are just the new projects, and those will get added to the overall TIP, the Transportation Improvement Program, which has many, many more projects that are already in the program moving towards funding. This is what you've been going over today is just the new stuff, correct?
Yes, thank you. Okay.
Thanks.
Yes.
Sorry, and then just one more thing. This is the Active Transportation Committee's opportunity to review these projects and make any, I guess, recommendations or provide input on them prior to them going forward to our Transcom committees and then ultimately to the council for adoption. So any comments that you'd like to make, certainly make them now or email us, let us know. But we want to make sure that the ATC is involved in that process from local recommendations of the tax, Active Transportation Committee review, and then that filtering up through Transcom and then ultimately to council. So we're utilizing this committee as a review board, essentially, for our TAP recommendations at a minimum, and also on a larger scale, what happens with Active Transportation and the other two funding programs. So if you have any input, recommendations, anything, review, please let us know, and we'll make sure that those comments are made prior to Transcom or go to Transcom from the ATC.
Perfect. Thank you.
Thanks, Ben. Okay, Ben number two, green bikes.
Good morning, everybody. So today I'm going to tell you about the different types of bike sharing in the U.S. with a focus on this new version called Dockless. Now, over the last 8 months, I've been following Dockless's expansion from China to the U.S. market and engaging with my industry peers on their experiences. Recently, I've begun meeting with some of these companies, their public policy people, strategic development and ops folks, plus the people in charge of regulating them to learn more about the model. I just got back from Seattle. I've got a call later today with Seattle, and I'll be visiting Dallas and Charlotte in May for further research. And using this info, we'll look at how Dockless is different than previous iterations of bike sharing in the US, and I'll make sure you're aware of some potential issues with Dockless that we've learned about, so that if anyone is interested in bringing this to their city or their community, you can use the information in this presentation to create a permitting process that best suits the needs of your individual community. So first and foremost, there's three types of bike share. Number one is dock-based. This is what's almost called a legacy system at this point. These things are about 8 years old. Salt Lake City, Washington, D.C., Minneapolis, New York City. The bike is locked into a docking mechanism, and it just goes from station to station. This is a model called Smart Bike. This is in Portland, maybe about 40 other smaller communities. It's very, very cool. It's still station-based, but all the technology is on the bike, and the dock is just a regular bike rack. So it gives you a little more flexibility. It's about 10% cheaper on capital expenses, and that cost savings, you basically lose, it's a more cumbersome checkout process. So you have to type a bunch of things in on this keypad, and then you use this U-lock, but it allows you to do things like, for an extra dollar or two, leave the bike wherever you want, so you could lock it to something else. So it gives a little more flexibility to the system. Third is this thing called Dockless. It's originated in China a few years ago. There is billions of dollars being dumped into this model by venture capital firms right now. And it's very, very cool. The idea is that you put out tons and tons of bikes, you leave the bike wherever you want, and you don't attach it to anything. So by far the most convenient thing for the end user. So while that is incredibly cool, there are some dangers. Right, so this is Seattle. Sometimes the bikes can bunch up. Since it's not locked to anything, they can be thrown in a river. The bikes can be destroyed pretty easily. Just because you can put down 10,000 bikes or 20,000 bikes in a city doesn't necessarily mean that you have a place to put them. So here's Dallas from this year. Granted, most of the time they don't end up in trees, but it does happen from time to time. So the three primary differences between Dockless and other kinds of bike share is one is the for-profit motive instead of transit. So about 75% of all of our rides come from annual users, and annual users only put in about 5% of the revenue. So we're really trying to make a decision on what's going to have the most longevity. The bikes are lower quality, so they're disposable. For example, in China, they reached a point of saturation where the police finally said, you need to come get these bikes, they're blocking the public right of way. And while this might seem like a very attractive mosaic, this is a police impound lot of 10,000 bikes because the company said it's more expensive for us to come pick them up than it is for you to impound them, so just impound them. And it's not necessarily anything sinister either. It's just a different approach, right? So we have this nonprofit model right now that's funded with these public-private partnerships. And if you're a big private company, you just have to make more calculated decisions. And it's gonna be, so here's another example of bikes getting ready for this lot. And the bikes are obviously left anywhere. Those are the three primary differences. So there has been some pushback. I'd say that the overall press coverage is about 60-40, 60 on the negative side, 40% on the this is the future, this is very exciting side. DC Deputy Mayor, don't park dockless bikes on the frozen canal. DC Police, stop calling 911 about dockless bike share bikes unless it's a real emergency. How is this not littering? Bikes on the subway. In Charlotte, they've already had about 800 complaints. A weird thing is that any city that has these systems has multiple social media pages dedicated to not liking them. So the Dallas Bike Mess Instagram page has 8,400 followers. And to put that in perspective, that's twice what the Green Bike Facebook page has. Dallas is where there's the most of these right now in the country. There's about 20,000 bikes. And up until July of last year, they had zero. And so they basically let all the companies in and do what you want to do. So what's happened is that since the motivation is different, the companies say that yes, we'll do these things, and they're not really able to accomplish some of them. And a lot of this can be changed, I think, with a proper permitting process. But if one company comes in, you kind of have to let them all in unless you have an exclusive contract. So even though the person from Dallas said that most of the bikes are already not being used, they still had to let this fifth company in. Oh, and there's basically Dallas has the most negative press out of any of them. Neighborhoods can be a little tricky. We went to Seattle recently and we found that only one of these companies actually has a customer service number on the bike. So if you bring it in, I would mandate that companies put a customer service number on the bike because these are people's front yards. Some smaller communities and some larger ones are saying, no, this isn't for us. This is in San Diego recently. This is in the city of Coronado. China has put a cap on them in most cities or banned some of them that haven't been good partners, as they put it. And they've cited saturation and ill management of the existing bikes. To put it in perspective, just one of these companies has 10 million bikes on the ground. So the Portland Transportation Division recently went over to Seattle and they surveyed 120 of these bikes and they found that 17% were unrideable due to damage. 39% had significant safety and maintenance issues, which is brakes, lights, and 44% were in good to fair condition.
So Ben, why don't you tell us how you feel about dockless systems?
No, it's incredible. It's an incredibly
there's a theme that's emerging here. There,
it's an incredibly cool thing because they're doing something that we can never do. I can't give you 20,000 bikes or 10,000 bikes in a month, but they can. And so what I want to do is make sure people are aware of some of these things because they're hiring the smartest people in the industry, paying them a lot of money. And this could be the future. That's why I'm meeting with them and we're trying to figure out, but you won't hear any of this stuff from anybody that's telling you about it. So I want to make sure that people are aware of it and then can build that into their permitting process. I don't think this is necessarily bad. This might be the way it's going to be from now on. But we still need to learn, and I want people to just be aware of it. But yes, we're going through. Let's see, Seattle and DC did a field study, tool design group. They looked at 233 bikes in 8 neighborhoods. They found that 30% of the bikes were parked illegally, which isn't bad for having 10,000 bikes on the ground. 20% chance of a user not being able to find a bike using the app, and 100 to 200% more bikes in an area than the app advertised. The National Association of Transportation Officials said that they pose a significant safety risk to the public and they're poor quality and often unsafe. So then real quick, we're just going to go through some of the risk factors. So one, lower quality. Their bikes, they will admit the bikes last about 1 to 2 years. They're manufactured about $50 to $300 a piece. The bikes that have traditionally been made by either B-Cycle or any of the other companies, they're lasting 5 years on the frame. That's the minimum warranty, but they'll probably last about 10. They're decreasing their safety inspection standards from, right now we do it every 2 weeks. These companies are saying they're doing it every 30 days. And you can mandate whatever you want for your individual community. If you want to kind of take the reins off and just see how it goes, that's what Dallas is doing. Seattle's put in more of a regimented process, but they said that they still need to figure it out. They need like version 2.0 and 3.0. This is something where they did an inspection of 983 of these OFO bikes, and they found that 31 to 55% of the bikes were either stolen for private use or damaged. Now, private use means, so if I have one of these bikes and I want to make sure that I have it, I would just take it into the office and like put it in my cubicle. Now, a person can't, nobody's GPS is that accurate in big cities, because the tall buildings kind of mess it up. So a person looking for that bike will walk up to near the building thinking it's outside of the building, but actually it's in, or somebody brings it into their apartment and then it's privatized because they don't have to leave it in the station.
But Ben,
yes, sir.
You presume that everybody knows this, but the way that people locate available bikes.
Oh, yes, I apologize. So the dockless model only uses an app. There are no paid stations at all. The traditional models, you walk up to any of the stations and you can just put your credit card in, or you can go online and somebody sends you a card, or you can use an app. The dockless ones are only app-based. So you download an app and you scan a little code, and that unlocks a rear lock that's on the tire of the bike, because it's not locked to anything.
But even just locating where a bike is, there's a GPS locator in each of the bikes,
yes.
Right?
All the dockless ones have a GPS on each bike, so you pull up the app and you see where all of the bikes are. The GPS function is, they're not quite there yet, but I imagine within the next year or so, it's gonna get pretty dialed into the point of being perfect. This is something I would make sure to request in your city. This was part of the original business model. So we don't do deposits when somebody checks out a bike, but this model was, the bike is $50 to $300, and then you put a $50 to $100 deposit or hold on everybody that signs up, but you're only gonna charge them like a dollar to use the bikes. So the goal would be to get hundreds of millions of users, each putting down $50 to $100 at a time. Now you have billions and billions of dollars that you can plug budget holes with, invest, gain interest on. And it turns out that's kind of like an unregulated bank, so they're figuring out what's okay and what's not okay. And the companies will say that they won't do this, but I just make sure to put that in your permits, because that was part of the original BC funding. They've received 210,000 complaints on this just from one company in China. We need to be aware that it is a high-risk business model. So the third largest one in the world started in November of 2016, raised $100 million in VC funding, picked up 20 million users, and had 700,000 bikes on the ground. It didn't make it a year before it went bankrupt, because the companies are run by Uber and Lyft executives, or former Uber and Lyft executives, and the model is take a lot of losses for 5 to 10 years in the hopes of becoming much more profitable down the road. So if they don't receive a new round of investor funding, the thing will crash. But in the meantime, and when that happens, there can be consequences. They're finding it's a little more difficult in Asia and the US than in China. This is something I would definitely make sure to put into your permit, that when they get rid of the bikes, that the bikes can be recycled. If you're putting out 10 million bikes every year and the bikes are only lasting 1 or 2 years, obviously that creates a lot of waste. And I guess what they're finding is that it's too expensive to take off all the individual parts on the bike to try and recycle it. It's easier to just dump it. make sure that when you ask for information that you're getting, that you're all measuring the same stuff. You're seeing examples pop up where people are citing things, and then right after, you're finding out that it's not necessarily the same. These are from the same day. OFO is the largest one, the 10 million users. They've raised over $2 billion in venture capital funding. They have been saying in the press they will not go into cities without the blessing of the local communities. Unfortunately, they were recently just kicked out of the North American Bike Share Association for preemption. Preemption means going to the legislature instead of working with local communities. So they're trying to pass laws in certain states saying that they can't be regulated, that cities don't have the right to put any sort of permit or structure. They tried it in Florida and it failed. I don't know if it's going through in Oklahoma, but that may be something on the table pretty soon. Surprisingly, the ridership isn't as high as we would have expected. So I think the gamble was that if you put out enough bikes and you make it convenient enough, you're going to have this massive increase in the number of rides. And what I think we found so far is that it's going to be a much longer conversation about infrastructure and culture. So in Capital Bike Share is the DC bike share program. They looked in October and they were getting 5.6 rides on every bike every day. The dockless companies were only getting one. And Denver 1.3 compared to the docks is 0.2. They're getting between 0.3 and 0.4 in Dallas. Seattle is getting between 0.3 and 0.5. We're averaging 1.6 over the last 3 years, but we obviously have fewer bikes. So the net effect, you're getting more rides in these communities like Dallas and Seattle, which is better. And they're free. So the standard price is usually a dollar for 30 minutes on the dockless model, but OFO has done the last 4 months entirely free, so you don't even pay that. You want to be aware of the diversion of public resources, because when that one company went bankrupt, in one city they had 70,000 bikes, and so this is a picture of the bikes that had to be cleared by the police. That's the same stuff from a different angle. Make sure you put in specific rules for how they do labor. They're trying to use the Uber Lyft model of sort of third-party labor, and there have been some articles popping up recently. And unfortunately, since the model has shifted to VC funding, startups are very, very, very competitive. And so you really have to do your research and make sure that you're all talking about the same thing, because there are these examples of the company saying everything is great, these are just rumors, and then it turns out like the CEO has been gone for months, the VP has been gone for months, the staff hasn't been paid for months. Yeah, there's literally an article titled Blue Go-Go's CEOs Apologize, but I still haven't got my wages and can't pay rent. And I know this all seems negative, but you're only going to hear the positive things from these companies, and they do have some very, very cool opportunities. And this might, like I said, this might be how bike share is done for the future. I just want to make sure that we're all aware of sort of what the consequences are. This is an interesting one, the danger to the disabled. DC is having a problem with this. Preemption, like we talked about earlier, going to the legislatures. I don't know if the WFRC has a policy on this or not, but this is sort of an important one to the North American Bike Share Association, that we say that bike share companies have to work with individual communities. They can't just try to go directly to the legislature to create a law to not be permitted. This is a big fear for me. Don't worry, we're wrapping up. But this is a big fear for me, is that if we lose the trust of individual communities and MPOs, transit agencies, that we're going to start to see more articles like this. Whereas, you know, we've had several hundred articles done on us. One was pseudo-negative. I don't know, kind of negative, but we're starting to see more stuff like this pop up. Almost lastly, they really can't control where the bikes go. What they're saying is that they're going to use an app that will incentivize the user on a point system to not drop off the bikes in certain areas, but at the end of the day, the bikes are going to go where they're going to go. The University of Utah did a one-week demo with one of these companies, and they said it was going to be a closed campus system. People will only be able to ride it on campus, and the next day they're out in Redwood Road and Sugar House and Foothill. they're, one of the other big points is that they say that they're addressing equity, which is a really good point because it's something bike share systems have really struggled with, traditional ones like myself. The bike share stations go where there's the most density and apartments, all that stuff. So we don't have a lot of them on the west side. We go to about 7th East to 7th West. So they're saying that we'll bring bikes to the larger community. Now, that's possible if they promise, or if you contractually obligate them to bring those bikes back out to that community every day. Because when we went to Seattle, we saw that they're only in the downtown core, same as everybody else, and that they were predominantly being used by university students, according to data from the Seattle DOT. You want to make sure user data. So this is from OFO's user agreement. It says your personal information will be processed by staff operating outside the United States. These are Chinese-based companies, so you need to make sure that you're getting that secured. And I think that's it. Oh, and then this will be the new thing. I don't know, I don't have any thoughts on this yet. I'm still trying to learn about it. Has anybody seen these scooters? This is gonna be intense. Scooters are coming everywhere pretty soon. I don't know what's coming. Yeah, they're electric scooters that'll go up to 15 miles an hour that are just being dropped off on sidewalks. But anyway, that's everything. Are there any questions? Yes, sir.
Yeah, so, I mean, one of the things I would say is as a municipal leader right now, I see no reason to even get involved with any bike sharing program. This is like a horror story. So I think it would be better if you kind of intersperse some of the good things about the docked programs
In
with this so that there's, I mean, in a way it needs to be balanced a little bit about there are some good things about the bike sharing program, but this, and I know maybe you're addressing this to us as your audience, but it's kind of like I'm basically going like that, you know, based upon this kind of stuff, looking at those pictures.
Yeah, like this to what?
To go away, you know, I don't want that in my jurisdiction.
No, I, if I had more time, I'd show you all of the positive things, but the positive things are pretty inherent. You don't have to pay for it. It's free.
Ben, let me,
yes, sir.
Sorry. Your point here today is that there's new approaches to bike share. In our region, we're using docked bike share.
Yes.
And it's working really well. And there's these new approaches that are docked less.
Yes.
And you're cautioning that there's going to be some companies that are saying, hey, folks, you can do dockless. And they're going to try to sell it as a positive, and there's really a lot of risks.
There are some concerns. And I'm not saying one version is better than any of the others.
And I think what I'm hearing Mayor Silvestrini say is the presentation today, there's a risk that people sort of lose the distinction that you're drawing.
Oh,
this is about dockless, as opposed to the notion that docked is working really well in our region. It sort of comes across as a bike sharing bag.
Yeah.
And that is clearly not your intention.
Yeah, as the executive director of a bike sharing program, that would not be in my best interest if
I
was.
Yeah, I'm just saying that you might want to talk a little bit and intersperse this with how the dock programs are different and how the, I mean, some of,
I think that's a very good point. I am realizing that in this moment.
Question right over here.
Also, it seems like many of the services that Green Bike, Salt Lake City Bike Share provides, is the care and maintenance of the bikes, and that's part of what is missing from the dockless model, is that they don't have the same commitment to taking care of their bikes, either long-term, because they don't last very long, or kind of in the short-term, like where they parked, etc. So I think you have some examples in your presentation of where things could be regulated, but it might also be helpful to like draw that connection for people. Like, you need to make sure that they have staff who are going to do this in order to make sure that the bikes are functional and safe.
Right. No, that's good.
And don't become littered.
Right. I think there are easily ways that you can permit this. End of the day, Green Bike's not going to be able to get to every community that wants it. You know, we're looking at all kinds of things over the next few years, whether we stay with our current model, maybe try a smart bike model, maybe some sort of hybrid. We can partner with the dockless companies. I just want to make sure that it's going to be safe and work for everyone, so I'm still doing research. But there are absolutely ways that you can try this, but you just need to make sure that you incorporate all the things that are important to you that we kind of brought up in that permitting process, because it is very, very cool. You can have as many bikes as you want in your community, but they will only enforce what you absolutely make them. Yes?
Ben, we funded a study that looked at how to regionalize green bike with UDOT, UTA, WFRC, and MAG, and I believe the conclusion of the study was that it would be a recommendation that UTA consider the regionalization of green bike.
That is accurate.
Is what I'm recalling. And now we're starting to see competition in the marketplace.
Mm-hmm.
There is no leadership at a district level to make this stuff happen. And so how are you dealing with these individual communities that maybe are contacting WFRC or Green Bike and saying, how do we get into the game, or is there any coordination taking place?
So right now we're in the middle of a regionalization process through this group called Pathway that the WFRC, UDOT, and a few other agencies like the county are helping with. The first step was for us to separate from the Chamber of Commerce and become a completely independent entity, and that part is done. Now they're looking at the financial marketplace and finding out how many foundation sponsors, etc., are out there, both for Salt Lake and for regional areas. And then the third phase that will be started in July is looking at how do we create this business model so that cities that want it can just sort of sign up and have a process they can just go through immediately. Ogden is the only city so far that has raised money and set it aside for a green bike system that they want to do. When anybody has a bike share system that they want in their community, we meet with them and we tell them, like, here's the process that we did, but it is kind of coming up short.
I remember some of the study looked at how this green bike was really a good first mile, last mile component of the transit system. It extended that transit trip into key destinations and really tied that stuff together well. I don't know if we have any UTA staff here. Do you know, Joe, do you know what the reason was that UTA declined to embrace green bike? Is that?
We couldn't afford it.
Couldn't afford it.
Yeah, I mean, the study's pretty clear that it would be great, if we could, but yeah, unfortunately, we don't have the financial wherewithal to take it on.
I mean, so essentially what's happening right now is that we operate this service just like a transit agency, where our fare box rate is around 35% to 40%, but that is contingent on us raising a lot of sponsor dollars. It's like UTA trying to pay for their services on bus wraps. And what's happening with the dockless companies is that the investors are funding the losses right now, and so they're getting a chance to try this for 5 years, or it could only last 2 years, or no one knows. But I get why UTA wouldn't be incredibly excited to take on any risk.
But still, your individual cities that are supporting you are taking on that two-thirds subsidy, is that right? So you're doing one-third fare box collection.
No, we just raise it all through private sponsorships. It's on the organization.
Private sponsorship.
Yeah.
So Select Health, right, the primary sponsor, and then there were different basket sponsors in the past. You can do the handlebar, there's the station sponsors, those all help contribute.
No, yeah, the cities haven't been on the hook for anything.
Salt Lake County just the...
Salt Lake County.
That's where some of the operations will come from.
That'll be the first time that we've received any operational funding through these HB 420 dollars to expand the green bike system out of the downtown area starting in 2019, 2020. But up until now, the last 6 years, it's just been what we gained in ridership and then what I raised in sponsor dollars.
Private sponsors through the chamber. Thank you.
It should be noted, I'd just like to add, I mean, Ogden City was approached by a couple different vendors. We have money in our tap for Ogden in 2022. The first thing that Justin Anderson did was said, get a hold of WFRC, we want to be on the same system as Salt Lake City. We don't want to have our users, you know, get into one system, buy an annual membership or daily passes, go ride the train down to Salt Lake and then have to get on a different system. And so Ogden City was very much supportive of being on one user system.
Right, and I think that was something that I think WFRC supports as we're programming these funding, our TAP funding or CMAC out in the future.
Yeah, I think that's always been the long-term goal, is we'd love to have one universal system where it's universities, it's different cities, and just one card allows you to tap everything. And I apologize, I think, Mayor, you're absolutely right. There should have been much more positive things. And you'll ask Andrew, usually it's just an onslaught of every positive green bike fact you could possibly imagine. So it's probably very jarring for everybody. But if there are any other, Becca?
Do you know if there are model ordinances that take into account all of these like lessons learned from communities? I know that Salt Lake City, we're working on our permitting process, and
right.
Alexis is taking the lead on that. But it seems like with the concern at the national level, with NACTO weighing in, et cetera, that someone should develop some model ordinances that suggest, like, you should have it be this, and this, and this, and this, and, like, real employees, and...
No, they're trying. So NAPSA has tried to push for more stringent stuff, but now the dockless companies are a part of NAPSA, and they're trying to make sure, I don't know, I'll be joining the board of NAPSA this year, and I'll be trying to push for those. Seattle has,
what NAPSA is?
Oh, sorry, the North American Bike Share Association. So it's the only sort of...
Not a P, but a B.
Seattle has a great permit, but after talking with the Seattle DOT and the person in charge of enforcing that permit, there are some big red flags. So I think Seattle's like second or third version, but no, I don't think anybody has it in right now, because mostly what's happened is there's been a rushed implementation because people have gone sort of the lobbyist route, and then cities kind of just get pushed into it, or there just hasn't been any good data.
And I also think, like, you can say, oh, we'll send out the police to round up the bikes, but our police are kind of busy doing other things.
Yeah, no, it's a good point.
So even if you have an ordinance in place, do you have the capacity to enforce your ordinance?
Enforcement. So in Seattle, there is one full-time employee and an intern regulating 10,000 bikes. And that's not really getting it done.
I had some experience this winter with a couple of these different systems in Europe, as well as San Francisco Bay Area, and the smart bikes seem to work really well, where you can sometimes put it in a dock, or you can mm-hmm. leave it where there are a bunch of other smart bikes, where there's kind of a designated area. Electric bikes are coming in some of the, there's the San Francisco electric, dockless electric bike share that's been just bought by Uber. Copenhagen has an electric bike share, which seems to work pretty well. So does Park City, you know, here. There's also one model that Ben did mention, which is, we wrote one called Donkey Bike, and it's a day rental. Like you can check the bike out for the entire day, but it's dockless, and you sort of bring it back to where you got it from, but it's just sort of out there. And the last thing is that some of these cities have like four different bike share companies, you know, docked and dockless, all coexisting. I saw some of the Lime bikes and Ofos, but I didn't see any of the problems that were mentioned here. They seem to be fairly well ordered in terms of where they, you know, where the bikes were dropped off, and you know, seemed to work pretty well. So.
Now, like I said, if you do it right, I think it's totally possible that it works efficiently. Did you have something, sir?
Just real quickly, I was in Phoenix last week and saw three different bike share companies, rode two of them. They seemed to be coexisting in the same fashion that he described quite well. They were really fun to use, of course, really easy to use. I had a question about the electric bikes.
Okay.
And your take on the kind of movement with Jump, mm-hmm. Uber's purchase of Jump. See what your thoughts are about where that technology
goes. I think e-bikes have the most transformative potential. I'm not a crazy bike person, but sold my car 6-7 years ago and just been using bike share stuff, and there are places that you couldn't get to unless you had an e-bike. The problem is that, like, we have to live in the sort of day-to-day, year-to-year model of, can we make enough to cover the expenses? And e-bikes are significantly more expensive to purchase and to operate, because you have to change the batteries out every like 2 days on every single bike. Now the question is, can you raise enough or bring in enough ridership revenue extra that will cover those costs? And there's no evidence so far that that's the case, but I'm really excited by the companies that are willing to take on that debt right now to see if it does work, because hopefully that could lower overall costs for everybody as it becomes much more mainstream. But I think that really is the next thing.
One more and then we're gonna move on. Go ahead.
Real quick, is that maybe this body might be able to address in San Francisco, they have the Ford Go Bike program, so it's similar to mm-hmm. Select Health, that they're a title sponsor, but most of the money, as far as I know, came from their regional transportation authority. They have 7,000 bikes going in over the next couple of years in 5 cities, and this is maybe a model that's a little more government funded than Green Bike is, and I don't know, you know, if there's a way to incorporate that either with UTA or UDOT or both. And
I would love more money from UTA and UDOT. That sounds great. All right, thank you.
Thanks a lot, Ben. Here's Scott.
Okay, perfect. We're actually going to have Heather start us off over here running the computer with some of the resources that we have, and then we'll just talk about the event as a whole. Do you want me to introduce? I mean, so the event, we've been talking about this for about a year. It's finally coming. All the pieces are coming together. So Saturday, June 2nd, we intend to have 2 simultaneous rides along with community events. So one ride beginning in about Dinosaur Park or Rainbow Gardens in Ogden Canyon, riding towards downtown Salt Lake City to the Jordan River Bridge at North Temple. The other ride, as far as we're starting it from MAG, we're going to start it from Palisade Park, which is the end of Murdoch Canal Trail on 800 North in Orem. But if you want to wake up very early in the morning, you can start at Bridalveil Falls, but that's an optional start. And ride from that point to the same location there in Salt Lake City, starting roughly 7 a.m. and 6:15 a.m., depending on where you're at. It's a longer ride from Utah County north. It's about 45 and 55 miles, respectively. And then we have community events that we're helping to coordinate along the way, which are kind of water stops, restroom breaks for the group of core riders. But then we've also heard from a number of communities and would love to hear from anybody around the table. I know Davis County has an event that they're planning and working with Salt Lake City on the actual event itself, which will be at Fisher Mansion to between 1 to 3 p.m. with speakers at about 2 o'clock to include the governor. So we are looking forward to this. Hope everybody can attend. Registration's open, and I'll let Heather tell us a little bit about what we've got.
Sure. Thanks, Scott. If you go to goldenspokeutah.org, it'll redirect you to this page. And we're trying to keep everything on this page, the most up-to-date information, just as like different things that finalists. Scott pretty much summarized the event description, which is written here. And then there's the specific times, start times here. There's more detail below, which I'll show you. On the right, there's a map with hotspots. And if you click on any of these icons, it'll take you to an external link of the different websites for the various trails that make up the Golden Spoke Network.
Which, if you are a local community and that isn't the right link to send them to, because not everybody has a government-sponsored or permanent location for the Denver Rio Grande Rail Trail. So some of these go to Facebook user groups or other external trail websites that have information about these trails. So please let us know if the link is different than the one you would like. So we've tried to just work as a committee to put this information together pretty quickly and get it out on the website.
Thank you. If you click on the View Flyer button, there's a flyer that's included in your packet. That we can give you more copies of, and I also have the files. I'll show you where you should get those. I'll let you know where you can get more flyers to print if you would like to share them. On the flyer, there's a short description about the event again. There's a map, and the map corresponds with the table with the tentative like ride times, locations of where you can enter the ride if you don't want to do the entire ride from the north or the south. There's also a link to the registration site, which came together. And so here, again, similar description. And she has set it up that when you register, you pick whether you want to start from the very beginning of the ride, or if you would like to start like somewhere in the middle, or if you just want to go to the event, and you can do multiple things. The registration is free. We're just trying to get a decent count of the people who would like to join, and that's why we're asking you to register. And then they're currently working on these Relive videos, which if you're not familiar with Relive, they're very cool. It links the Strava data with kind of like a Google Earth fly-through, I would say.
Could you pull the one, the test run from
I looked at it, but yeah, it's not on here yet because they're going to fix it up a little bit more. But so we're going to add those pretty soon. I think he said he's going to have them today or this week, and they are, it's very cool. So we'll add those. This kind of mimics the information on the flyer, and like I said, this information will be continuing to be updated, but I think it's pretty solid at this point, and it clearly defines where we think like a range of time that the riders will stop at the different locations. So if you want to meet up, you don't want to do the whole ride, but you want to meet up, you know, at Legacy Park, this is the approximate time that they'll be there. And it's also open to not only bicyclists, but runners and walkers, etc. We have itineraries in the north and the south. And then this is going to be the space for community events. And so we're asking people, if you would like to advertise your community event, you could send me the information and I can put a link on here to your event. And just so everything's in a central location. We're also working on food and entertainment and going to have food trucks there. So we have 3 trucks so far. And then UTA has donated, I think, approximately 200 passes. And so the idea is that if riders ride from their location and they don't want to ride back, they can pick up a pass at the UTA table and they can take transit back home. We're also working on getting some sponsors. And then we have numerous partners in this, and so these also link to the partners' websites and sponsors' website. So I think that covers the website. I've also provided in the packet a communications content. And so we're asking, I've emailed all of the communications contacts that I have information for at like the different cities and counties. And we've asked them if they could like include this newsletter content or similar content in their newsletter. Or there's also on the backside social media content, if they could, you know, post some social media posts. There's also a link to the Facebook event. And this information, if you would like me to email to you, you're welcome to contact me and I can get it to you. We also have a Google Drive where you can have access resources, and you can email me and ask for access to that drive. In there you'll find like the various logos and the maps, the newsletter content, the social media content, flyers, etc. So we are more than willing to share any of that information with you. That's it.
No, just two things. One is we printed stickers, which I think legitimizes this whole thing. I mean, once they're stickers, so I would, you know, encourage you to make sure you pick up a sticker. We'll have about 500 of those that we're printing right now. And then the second piece is that in our research, this is the second longest continuous paved trail in the nation, and the longest west of the Mississippi. So our competition right now is the Paul Bunyan Trail in Minnesota. That starts right up near the headwaters of the Mississippi. Like, I think you can throw a rock from there to where this begins. So we're just west of the Mississippi, but that's 112 miles. This is 101.03 or something along those lines, with the opportunity at the Ogden River and Weber River break to the north to actually continue the trail north and get to Brigham City to Sardine Canyon. So I think long-term Golden Spoke is to figure out what this means for cross-state more than just our cross-region, but as of right now, you can get from mouth of Ogden Canyon, mouth of Provo Canyon, and really you could go probably further south if you jumped off of Murdoch and entered into trail systems within Utah County, but this is a pretty clean line that we can show right now. So the American Trails website, or it was American Trails Magazine, it used to be a printed magazine, it's now an online editorial. has asked us to write an article for this, and that will get the information out on their webpage, which Wikipedia says is the place to figure out information on the longest paved trail. So again, that's very legitimate, I feel like. But there's just no other governmental agency that's tracking longest paved trail. So this is our research that we've done, and until somebody comes out of the woodwork to bump us off and say that theirs is longer, I think we have a really incredible resource here, and it's time to begin promoting all these different pieces that have finally gelled and come together at this point.
So. They also, right, Scott, they distinguish between a spiderweb network of trails versus one continuous right. long one, because we have the Pratt Trail, there's the separated trail that comes out past the airport here, it'll eventually go out, you know, I mean, you have the Friends Road here that you could get out to Salt Air. I mean, there's quite a few things that will hub and spoke off of the, right. the main north-south line that I think we should continue to keep yep. working on also.
Right. Yeah. So I was going to say that I think it's maybe incumbent on local jurisdictions to maybe augment this. I'm going to talk to these guys about actually organizing something that I think we can get the East Bend cities, suburban cities, Mill Creek, Holiday, Cottonwood Heights, to run something down Wasatch Boulevard, start someplace, and then come down that Parley's Trail to join this and figure out the time that we need to do that on. Andrew's promised to ride with me on that. So, but I think, you know, in terms of some of these other spurs, getting more people involved, that's a good way to do it. So I'll be in touch with you guys about just figuring out what we need to do, and then my city will promote that. I'll talk to Holiday and Cottonwood Heights about helping with that as well. Maybe to Andy too, I don't know.
Okay, thank you very much.
Question back there.
Oh, so Mayor, I am meeting with the Pratt Board this afternoon, and so can talk to them about the possibility of
The one question I have about that is just what the connection's going to be from where that kind of ends to get to the Jordan River Trail. There's a couple blocks there. We just have to figure out a route and make sure we have a safe way to get from there off the trail. But I figure we can work on that with South Salt Lake or something like that.
And there's a couple spots that are really tight. So having more than a couple people go through is going to take
It's going to take some resources to make that safe.
I just emailed you the relive link again. So I don't know if you want to pull it up in your email. Barry, do you want to talk at all about what Davis County is currently planning?
Yeah, sure. First, let's say we're real excited about this event. It's going to be a great event, but we are running into some challenges in putting our portion of it on. As you know, big chunk of ours is on the Denver Midland Rail Trail. On the rail trail, we have all those gates. We did a test run a couple of weeks ago and feel like there is no way this is going to work unless those gates are open.
Yeah.
And
at least one side, right?
Yeah, at least one side. And some cities are, and that's in control of each city that it goes through. So it's not like we can go to one entity and say, hey, open up the gates. Some cities are okay with it, others are not. Layton City, for instance, has got a real problem. It tells us we've got to have one, a permit. And if they open the gates, they're going to require a police presence at every road crossing, which we have to pay for. And there is no budget for this. So we're not quite sure how to overcome some of these issues yet. But we're working on it. We do have three stops. We're really looking at one stop in Davis County and Farmington. We'll have a couple other locations where there's, we'll just flag that there's a bathroom here if you need to pull off and stop, and we'll have some water available, whatever. But looking at times, we think getting a significant number of people to Salt Lake on time, we're going to have to limit stops as few as we can. So we'll have a one planned stop in Farmington. The rest of them would be just kind of brief. If you have to stop, do so, and then catch up with the group. So there'll be one of those in Clearfield and one in Woods Cross City. And they might have some snacks or things at those places as well.
Do
do you want that? And then the handoff with the mayors, is that you guys are coordinating? Is that still?
We're hoping, but we're not sure how well that's going to work. We're not getting a lot of cooperation out of Weaver County. In fact, their guy was assigned to this initially, was told to back off, and they're going to have nothing to do with it. So, you know, it really only works if you've got all the mayors participating, and we're still working on that. We're hoping that can be accomplished. We can get the things fabricated. The Layton City has said they can do that for a reasonable price, and they're willing to. So we just got to make sure we've got mayors to participate.
Yeah, so the idea would be that you guys have talked about that each city participant, their elected official, carries a spoke or a baton, basically, that gets passed through the ride. And then at the end, there's a physical wheel or golden spoke structure, basically.
And
maybe
a golden spoke that would be placed by whoever, the governor or somebody at the last. But it also really functions the best if every city from the south and the north are participating along the way. We haven't heard from the south, so we don't know if there's willingness there or not.
Sean is coordinating the MAC portion of it. So
that's right. We just started to do some press on it, distributed flyers, and you know, we're starting to do some outreach to our mayors and technical committees.
We'll work on that. We'll get the thing fabricated. Hopefully we can get everybody, at least some person. It doesn't have to be a mayor. I guess it can be a city council person, someone from the city, to carry their spoke.
And then you got Helen Peters of Salt Lake County, who's helping us as well. So thank you for your involvement. And then Soren Simonson of Jordan River Commission. So if you have any questions, and a community email went out that went to elected officials, city staff, engineers, planners, some planning commission, city council. We used our small area meeting list, so it was pretty broad in our area. And so I've already been contacted back by city council members within cities who want to host events and need information. So hopefully that got the word out a little bit further. Heather had contacted the public relations folks. So if somebody else within your city, if you end up hearing about it or need contacts, feel free to send them my way, and then I can get them to the appropriate county person who's helping coordinate local events. And otherwise, just general information, certainly ask me. And then we have, this is a test run of the entire length of the ride, but we'll have these relive videos available on the website, which I think are kind of cool. So this starts in Ogden, and it follows a little line so you can see the trails that you end up on. So that's the Ogden River Network, and then there's a short on-road connection, then you're on Denver Rio Grande, all the way through Layton, Clearfield Layton, and in Farmington. There's Farmington Station, and then you end up on Legacy Parkway right here. So there's Davis County border, Salt Lake. Then you're on the Jordan River Trail. That's about right there, is effectively the location of the final event. So this is just a run through of the entire length. So we're gonna have two relive rides. So you'll have a south to north, north to south. But this was just a test run to see how this works. And Bert Granberg and Matthew in our office worked on this. They actually took a GIS line that we had were able to make perfect on the trail, and then kind of fibbed it into Strava, and then pushed from Strava into Relive. And so if you notice in Farmington, it said 181 miles an hour.
Yeah.
So they utilized GPS points like every few seconds and then fit this into Strava. So when they opened it up in Strava, they had King of the Mountain everything, like on the entire, so they deleted that line out. And they're gonna make one a little more reasonable where the speed puts them in like fourth or fifth place, because that's the way that we have to do this to get the Relive ride. Just kind of funny, but the first ride was they were going 181 miles an hour on the trail, which was, I kind of chuckled.
Airplane.
Yeah, exactly. So watch for those, and thank you everybody for your coordination. It's really your event, and we're helping coordinate, but we're looking forward to it.
Thanks, Scott. Are there any agency or county program updates you can talk about?
Yeah, I'd like to give a brief update from UDOT. So, in the last month and a half, we've gotten RSG under contract to assist with a statewide, but mostly focused on our MPO areas, active transportation data management plan. So this is taking our Strava data, our local counts from like Salt Lake City, for instance, Park City, anywhere that MAG has probably the highest density of counters in the state, and any other active transportation data information that we have. So our pedestrian actuations at UDOT signals, those are incorporated into the data system of our signals. So anything that's related to active transportation and data is going to be incorporated into this management plan. So we'll have a framework for members of government agencies and the public to go to the central repository, access the data they need or that they want. And then as part of RSG's scope, they're also going to be helping Salt Lake County and Salt Lake City with figuring out a deployment strategy for future counters and where like good locations for them are, so that we can better understand where users are riding, what the return on investment or usage is for certain facility types. So there's going to be a variety of deployments from on-road infrastructure to pathways. And so RSG will be helping with that. And then additionally, we'll be helping with Wasatch Front's and MAG's transportation modeling and incorporating active transportation data into that process. So it's kind of a big scope, and it's kind of going to be hyper-focused that the completion date is in another 7 months. So we have a lot of stakeholder engagement. We're actively reaching out to people that are collecting data in the state. And we hope to have this onboarded and ready for the public and other agencies to use by October.
Thank you.
Quick announcement. I just wanted to let everyone know about the Range to River Relay. Range to River Relay. This is an event put on by the Seven Canyons Trust, partnered with a lot of the people here. This is a bike boat run relay that happens May 12th. It starts down the City Creek pathway and then goes north up the river and then finishes at the fair park. This is just a kind of a fun thing for a local nonprofit. $60 for a team to register, and registration ends April 30th. So there's these flyers right out there if you want to get more information on their website. It's a really fun thing, May 12th.
Thanks, Mary. Anybody else?
On May 4th, there's a mobile active transportation tour in Richfield that's focusing on rural communities' access to active transportation. You can register on the Bike Utah website by May 1st, and those are all self-funded tours. So if any local elected officials or city folks want to be involved in that, go ahead and register and get yourself down to Richfield.
Who's organizing that?
That one's Phil Sarnoff and Betsy Byrne. Thanks.
Okay. All right, any motion to adjourn?
So
second. Second. All in favor?
Aye.
Okay. Thanks, everybody.
Thanks.